Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Welcome to Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast.
Building things can be really hard, and entrepreneurship is often portrayed in the media as the sexy or even worse, easy career path. Through this series, we plan to pull back the curtain and tell the gritty stories of entrepreneurship. We're striving to create a relaxed environment where entrepreneurs feel free to tell their stories.
This is Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast.
Hi there, it's Jeremy Scheinwald with another Smart People Should Build Things Venture for America podcast. Today on the show, we have Amol Sarva. He's a man of many identities. He launched Peak, which was like a stripped-down BlackBerry years ago, and got wide user adoption and acclaim from Oprah, Time Magazine, and more, as you'll hear on the show. Now he's on the cutting edge via Halo Neuroscience, which is pioneering the use of a non-invasive neurostimulation technology to unlock cognitive brain power. You'd think he's a hardcore tech guy, but he has a PhD in philosophy from Stanford. He also has an eye for art and design. He has a photo in MoMA's permanent collection and also led the development of a 20,000-square-foot residential building that echoes some of the bronze sculptures of Richard Serra. He's been an advisor to and launched many companies, as you'll hear. Please join us as we try to unlock the riddle that is Amol Sarva. Thanks so much for being here, Amol. Fascinating story as I looked into some of your history. You have a PhD in philosophy, a photo in the MoMA's permanent exhibit or collection. You sold and advised several companies, built a 20,000-square-foot building in Queens. How did you...
I think you got the wrong Wikipedia page for this one. I'm just screwing around with you, sir.
I don't think I wish this was TV so you could see my face go white.
Hilarious.
Oh my god, that is hilarious. Okay,
I'm pretty sure I'm the only Amol Sarva in the entire world. Actually, that's such a short name.
Oh boy. Okay. Whew, back on track here. Why? How do you? This is sort of a weird why aren't you? But because you've chosen a path where you've been quite successful. Why aren't you? A photographer or an architect or even a professor or any number of other things, because you seem to have many talents.
Oh, wow. That's a weird way to get started. I don't know.
It's my toughest interview yet. You've bad research, then I'm starting with weird questions.
I'm outraged that you would say. No, I mean, that's a fascinating and interesting question. And actually, it's what's surprising is that it is unusual, because I think many entrepreneurs actually are super creative people and see themselves that way. They see themselves. I mean, I was just, someone posed this exact question to a room of 50 entrepreneurs 10 days ago. And the question was we're here listening to some artists talk. How many of you folks in the room think of yourselves as deeply committed and involved in the arts and creative work? And almost every single person in the room raised their hand. Hmm. And I definitely think that about myself. I think my work is creative work, actually. And it's not that different from making art or... music or any other creative discipline. The way you posed it is why am I not doing that? I sort of think I am, actually.
Right. But could you have dedicated your life to, to photography and could that have been a viable path for you? Could you have, or one of these other paths?
I almost became a philosopher.
Right.
I was, I did the whole thing. I was even, interviewing for jobs at universities a little bit. And I didn't. The reason I didn't is I think this is similar things are true for a lot of other related, solo creative enterprises. And it's just that it's not very fast. You don't actually, have an urgent task list each day, and when you do everything, nothing seems to happen very quickly.
Right.
So those two qualities are very different in the world of company building and entrepreneurship. And I'm, you know, maybe it's just personality stuff, like the way people are wired in their rhythms and what they're used to and prefer. But when I got to graduate school in philosophy, I really liked philosophy, and I really liked, you know, the problems we worked on and the way we did the work and thinking. And I had the kind of self-discipline to spend long periods of time concentrating on hard stuff. But I really didn't like that you more or less worked alone, that you worked really slowly on one thing at a time, and that when you were done, pretty much nobody really cared about it. And, you know, I feel like a lot of people in the arts have a cycle like that. I mean, there's a tiny slice of folks who are, like, at this kind of effervescent boiling point of unbelievable, you know, fame and all that, but you can't design your whole, you know, expectation of your career to be, like, the most famous artist in the world, which is probably fun. I mean, that's probably super fun.
Right. Well, it seems like you balance that PhD where you were at Stanford with some of the slowness of that experience with some pretty impressive speed. Like, you were director of business development at Gobi during that time, and then a founder of Virgin Wireless. This is while you were at Stanford, right?
Like, yeah.
Did you
get a class
at all? Like, yeah. When did you work on your? Were you working on, like, a part-time PhD at night while helping to launch Virgin Wireless?
I guess graduate school is like pretty flexible in when you have to be places and do things. And so, yeah, a lot of the time I was sort of moonlighting on other projects. And sometimes I even was off for like 6 months from school at a time.
Right.
Just gone working on like that startup called Gobi, where we were basically giving out free computers. It was 1999. We were like, hey, sign up for our internet and you can have a free computer. It didn't work out very well, but it was a formative and interesting experience. And it totally set me up for what we did with Virgin Mobile. Virgin Mobile was almost the exact same thing. The whole cell phone business is giving you a free small computer to pay some kind of monthly
right.
fee to do stuff. And that the reason I got involved with that, and because it was because of what we had done with Gobi and what I had learned about how to do that kind of marketing and analysis. It totally started as like a little bit of a sideline. You know, I just went and met a guy. He's like, hey, I want to start a mobile phone company. I'm like, maybe I can like carve out a little time the next few weeks and I'll do a little thing and then see if we want to work on it more together. And that developed and developed and developed, and Virgin was an investor in Sprint, and it became a really big business. And by the end, that's all I was doing. And I had to go back and finish writing my dissertation after Virgin Mobile.
So, speak of the dissertation, can you just like dumb it down for us? Because I wrote this down. You got and I know I've got the right MLS. Sorry. it's a concept of modularity in cognitive science. Can you make that bite size for the layman here?
For sure. Yeah. I mean, it's a super simple idea, actually. The brain has parts and they talk to each other. That's a thing we now know about the way the brain works. And that has a bunch of much more sort of technical and theoretical problems that it raises for other theories about how the mind works. And my dissertation was just about that. It's like, okay, chapter one, the brain has parts and they talk to each other. We know that now. Chapter two, there's some people who say the brain works this way. Well, if it has parts, then it can't quite work that way. You know, chapter three, four, five. So essentially, I was just exploring some of the recent implications in the way people learn how the mind works. And it's super interesting. I mean, everybody, I'm sure, has a little bit of interest in just how the brain and the mind work. It's very topical these days, just in science and tech, and there's a lot of popular interest in it. And that was more or less why I did it. I found it really rewarding. But it did put me in touch with some amazing people and ideas, and has had a big implication in what I'm doing now. Like, one of the companies I'm building right now is like a direct straight line from the stuff we learned about back then.
To Halo.
Yeah, Halo Neuroscience. Okay. Yeah, I mean, this company that I started with a friend of mine a couple of years ago is a hardcore neuroscience company. Like, only a tiny fraction of people on the planet had ever heard about the type of technology that we have been developing. And I first heard about it when I was in grad school. Like, I read some random article about some guy who had some really out there theory, and he was developing some kind of technique. The guys in my department all said it was nonsense, could never work. Paper seemed very unserious. It was some Australian physicist who had published a paper about making people better at art through some kind of brain stimulation. Like he had some cap that he would put on you.
Is that just like academic snobbery? Had that guy come out of Stanford? Would they have been like, this guy's a genius?
I think there was a bit of it. I mean, that's why I told you he's from Australia. Right. So everyone's automatically like, well, he's kind of at the periphery of some of the neuroscience stuff. And all the Stanford guys took themselves very seriously. They're great philosophers from Australia. They're well-regarded. And, you know, Australia's well-regarded. But still, just being from Australia means he might be a little weird. And he's a physicist. He's not a psychologist or neuroscientist. And he had this really goofy, hard-to-quantify result, which is about, like, drawing pictures well. So they were like, yeah, whatever. It's probably not real. You know, the way people sort of dismiss a lot of possibly interesting science. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of a student. I thought it was interesting, and I just sort of left it for a long time. And after my last company in 2012, I was just thinking of the most interesting and most potentially, you know, powerful ideas I'd ever heard of. And that one had stuck with me for a really long time. I started looking into it, and it turns out in the decades since I had been exposed to those ideas, the field had actually developed. It had gone from like this one slightly zany dude to a field of a few dozen people who had published a few hundred papers, some really interesting stuff that I could maybe even make myself now, because in the intervening decade I had done all this like mobile phone and tech and gadgets and all that, and I was no longer nervous about electronics. Like I felt like I could make very complicated technology products. So I was like, yeah, you know, if this thing kind of works, maybe it's maybe that's like the next smartphone. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's like a brain gadget that somehow, I don't know. So I got some of the papers, I read them, I called around for some friends who might be able to help me a little bit, and we made a prototype device that can stimulate your brain and make your brain work better. And we tried it out.
Right.
On me.
and now you're smarter?
If anything, it's probably a temporary effect. But we, the first couple trials we did, like, we really had no clue how to use it or where to put it. Like,
okay, let's back up.
It didn't even occur to us to use the battery.
Give us the visual of like what are you putting? And is this like right on science fiction? You're putting nodes on someone's head and
Like electrodes on different parts of your head, and you design a certain circuit to keep too much energy from flowing through the electrodes. And I just like plugged it into a wall. Like I literally got like a wall adapter that people use for cell phones, and like just snipped off the cell phone adapter and rewired the stuff to some transistor we had created.
A homemade brain stimulator.
Pretty much, yeah. Like, pretty much, yeah. I mean, we just got ourselves
plugged
like
into a wall.
Yeah, I mean, we got like a little excited about it. I thought there was no point in just like reading five more papers. We should just see if we can get a result by fooling around with the technology a little bit. I convinced myself and my colleague, his name is Lee, we convinced ourselves that it was probably pretty safe, you know. Mm. In retrospect, it's I mean, even at the time, it was a little foolish, but yeah, so then we went to Radio Shack and we just bought a bunch of stuff. We took out our scissors. We had a desk full of all these gadgets. We had a few little lights on the thing to try to test it and make sure, you know, give ourselves some feeling that we had sort of done it right. It took hours to even just get this very simple circuit right, because neither of us is an actual electrical engineer. We just had sort of hobbyists' expertise. Right. And the very first time I tried it, I thought we had, like, shorted out all the lights in the office. So, like, we turn it on, and everything just goes completely pitch. Actually, it goes perfectly white. And I'm like, shit, oh, I can't see anything. What happened? The lights must have just, like, completely gone freaked out. A few seconds later, the lights are okay. So I'm like, okay. So Lee, you know, is this thing working? And he's like, yeah, it seems to be working. So I wait a little while. And then after a few minutes, I'm like, okay, let's turn it off. So he does something and I go blind again. And I'm like, Lee, did we just like mess up the lights? Did you see that? And he's like, no, I didn't see anything. What are you talking about? And it's because when we had sent like a big blast of energy straight through my optic nerve, and I blinded myself for a few seconds both times. Which was a little bit scary. That was kind of.
This is a story I have yet to hear on this podcast. What? So how did you determine that this was a net positive experience? That this was something that like did make you more cognitively sharp?
Oh
like,
man!
While it was on your head afterwards.
Well, I mean, at first I would just wanted to be sure I wasn't like injured.
Right.
But I mean, with a little more perspective and context and understanding of what had happened, we had used a very low amount of energy. That was the plan. And we had designed the circuit right. Everything was cool. But we more or less just shot it from, like, temple to temple, if you imagine just, like, putting one electrode on each of your temples.
Right.
Well, the shortest path between those is just, like, straight through right behind your eyes, which is where your optic nerve goes.
Right.
If you send a little energy into your optic nerve, you're going to see some stars or some lights or whatever. If you whack yourself on the head or, like, there's a lot of other ways you can create this kind of optical illusion or visual. impairment for just, it'll be brief, and it really doesn't have any long-term effect, whatever. Don't do it at home. It's not like I'm advocating it, but it was no big deal.
How many fingers am I holding up?
Right. I can't even see you. So it was no big deal, and it didn't have any benefit. But in the months afterwards, we tinkered with the location and duration and the waveform and the electromagnetic field and all this stuff, and we started producing some really amazing results.
Can you tell us about those, or is that confidential at this point?
I mean, it'll trend into the confidential territory, but some of the first things we did is we, like, played video games and beat them all.
Oh, really?
Like, it was very amazing, yeah. It was very amazing. And when we started doing that...
That's insane.
We were like, wow, that's... I mean, science usually doesn't work. When you do science, as my one of my colleagues says, like, the basic axiom to take when you're working on, like, cutting edge technology is that it's probably not going to work.
Right.
You're going to just try it and it's not going to work. It's like when I blinded, you know. But then, like, the next trial, I got 5 high scores in a row in some crazy game, and it's like, I mean, could it be placebo? Maybe. Like, our very first trials were not super rigorous. Over time, we became a lot more rigorous in what we were doing, and we were able to narrow in on some interesting stuff. And it was just working right from the beginning. So it's a super powerful, like, really interesting technology.
What is the, like... What's the long term, like, is this a consumer product? Is this like a, like, what's the vision for how this
yeah,
plays out?
Well, I mean, it has vast potential. Like, I won't get into the whole, like, what are we going to do with it exactly, but
right.
I mean, if you could build a technology that could make your brain work better, you have to do it.
Right.
I mean, there are so many ways that the brain is involved in all the important things we do, all the things we want to do, all our highest aspirations. If you could improve brain function for climate researchers and cancer scientists, if you could improve the speed of learning for, you know, whatever, kids from every different socioeconomic class, or, you know, folks working on the most cutting edge problems, like, you have to do it. And then for everybody, like, who wouldn't want to improve the way they just do their most important stuff? Thinking
right.
is, you know, it's even more than ordinarily. Your average kind of man on the street would say thinking's important, but thinking's even more important than they realize. The cognition, like all the different stuff that falls into cognition, that's learning, and it's math and arithmetic, and it's memory and long-term memory, short-term memory, visual processing, reaction time, motor function, skill, power, endurance. All those things are controlled by your brain. It's amazing the range of stuff you can connect with, your mood and your concentration, your focus.
Right.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it. This is Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast, a show about entrepreneurs and their stories.
So looking at your not Wikipedia page, but your About Me, your LinkedIn, other articles about you, is this your you're doing a lot of stuff still. Is this your main focus? I mean, is there a 9-to-5 for you at Halo?
Halo is a huge part of what I work on every day, but it is the minority of what I do. My co-founder in the company, Dan Chow, is a super amazing guy, and he's the CEO. All the people report to him. He has a little bit more of a hardcore technical background in the neuroscience than I do. Like, he's actually an MD. He actually has a master's in neuroscience. He spent 10 or 12 years at this really big med tech company that makes real medical devices.
Right.
I was making, like, smartphones for playing games and texting friends, but he's been working on some of the real neuroscience. So when he and I came together to start working on this, it was a very, we are complements in a lot of the skills we've developed over the last.
So, like, I sort of keep coming back to this, like, really, this diversity of things that you're working on at a time, and it's really interesting to me. Someone has a pretty short attention span himself, but one thing that, like, sort of, to me, like, is an interesting potential deviation from that is that when you finish your PhD, you go to McKinsey, which to me is, like, I think, known to be all-consuming, although you did still have one or two other things on the go at the time, but very structured, not a lot of room for that kind of dabbling and flexibility. Why did you make that choice to go to McKinsey, and what did you get out of it?
Yeah, well, when I finished, I joined McKinsey in 2003, middle of 2003, and I was thinking maybe I should start another company. I was like, I had moved to Paris. I was like finishing off my dissertation and waiting for my board of whatever they're called to read it. Mm-hmm. And I was just kind of screwing around, and I was like, all right, well, you know, I need to like get to my next thing. What am I going to work on? What do I want to do? And I was thinking I should start a company, but I didn't think I was qualified really to start a company. It sounds weird. Like I had been part of, you know, I was the junior guy. Like my co-founder was really the serious guy at Virgin Mobile. He's 10 years older than me. He had done a bunch of things in business. And although it was his first startup, he was sort of a more together dude. And while I feel I had a, you know, a pretty good role in what we did at Virgin Mobile, I was like dragged along, you know. It was cool to be there. It was my privilege. And we definitely made some mistakes in what we were doing. And so in 2003, when I was, you know, I'd been at Virgin for 4 years, I'd vested, I'd left, and I was sort of on the beach, and I was finishing up my dissertation, thinking about coming back. And I was like, maybe I shouldn't start a company yet. It was still the post-crash from 2001. Things weren't so hot. And I think that was totally wrong, but that was the reason why I went to McKinsey. I was like, well, you know, it's a good place, all these great people. I just finished my dissertation, so I looked to them like one of their typical kind of, you know, recruits into the postgraduate kind of program. I'll get back to New York. I'll kind of get myself sorted out. I had been previously in San Francisco and in Europe, and I'll sort of get rolling. But it turned out McKinsey was great. I mean, McKinsey was really good. They're amazing people who work there.
Right.
And that was the most rewarding thing about the whole experience. I didn't have a lot of hobbies. That's true.
Right.
While I was,
but yet you still found the time to start Blue Mobile while you were at McKinsey. Right. Is that?
Yeah. Well, I was still talking to my old co-founder from Virgin, this guy John Tantum, and our dialogue had continued, you know, pretty much uninterrupted. And at some stage I was like, okay,
so
let's go.
So that's with him. Blue Mobile is with him, and you guys raised like $18 million.
Yeah.
What was Blue Mobile?
Yeah.
And how was it different than?
Yeah, it was basically Virgin Mobile. It was supposed to be Virgin Mobile just again, and it even had its own crazy European billionaire involved. The Virgin Mobile stuff, the main
as it
guy
should,
was
as
obviously
it should.
Sorry.
As it should.
Right, as all good adventures. So yeah, so Richard Branson was, you know, the very famous dude. But then when we did Blue Mobile, my co-founder John just like called a guy after seeing his profile in Business Week. He was an entrepreneur who had built a big mobile phone business in Ireland. His name is Dennis O'Brien, and he just like phoned him up and said, "Hey, you did a mobile phone business in Ireland. You're doing one in the Caribbean with all these different island countries where you got these licenses. What do you say? You want to do one in the U.S.?" And the guy's like, "Yeah, perfect. That's exactly what I've been looking for. I'll meet you at the Teterboro Airport like in 2 days or something." And it was this crazy, like, I think it was only like 9 or 12 months or something that we were even working on the thing. We were just like burning money like crazy. The guy was very loose in his thinking and process. So he just invested tons of money, said, "Go do all this stuff." And everything was going amazing. We signed a deal with Verizon to be our partner to launch the phones in Walmart. So we were like 99% of the way to doing Virgin Mobile. Because Virgin Mobile, the two hard things when we did that, one was to get a partnership with Sprint and to get them to invest. The other part was to get our launch partners, our retailers, ready to go. Because in those days, that's where you would find stuff. You'd find stuff in stores. Now, nobody goes to stores. But then we got Best Buy to invest, and we got Target to launch our product. So we were all over the country in these amazing stores. Everyone saw us. It was a sensation. MTV was involved. And so when we did Blue Mobile, we were like, all right, let's go get all that stuff again. And we did it. We got Verizon, and we got Walmart. And we're like, this is good. We're going to be the even cheaper, less sexy, like, you know, burner phone that everyone will buy. And at the like last minute, I learned why working for these billionaires is a pain in the ass. So he won an auction for a wireless license in Fiji, like in the South Pacific. So he had done it in Ireland, some islands. He had done it in the Caribbean, some islands. And he had put his name in to win some like new operating territories. And he got them. And he's like, oh, all right, I'm going to be spending a lot of time in the South Pacific. This thing in the U.S., forget it. I'm done.
He's pulled the funding.
Yeah, I mean, the money was spent. He just, like, but it's a little inelegant when you, like, get all the way to building a business and then have, like, no more money. It's very difficult to go raise money for that.
Did you guys try, or did you just let it go after that?
Oh, well, we took a crack at it, but it's not an easy thing to do. If you, I mean, there's a long, convoluted set of things about the way the venture capital world works and early stage companies work. But yeah, I mean, it just wasn't practical. Like the guy had put us on this path where we were spending shitloads of money every month. And a super aggressive path where the plan was we were going to spend $50 to $100 million, and we spent a big chunk of the way into it. You can't just turn on a dime and turn it into like a more traditional VC backed like miserly effort where you put in a few million and get some big result and then a few million more. Like he had done, we were sort of set up to run out of cash. So we found some other smaller wireless operator to buy the business from us, and we just left it and let them try to develop it. They never took it very far. But that experience with Blue Mobile, I realized, okay, there is a reason why the venture world works a certain way. The kind of like the single high net worth backer is a very fickle kind of backer. It's not, if you want to be like a professional entrepreneur, it's better to work within the venture system than it is to like go find some person who might change their mind or get sick or have some wacky thing happen. Someone who's so completely lopsided in their power dynamic with you that you can just get hosed.
Right. That's interesting. And so obviously like mobile and when wireless is starting to like become a theme in your life, you soon after start Peak, which is why don't I let you, I'm not going to put words in your mouth, I mean, tell us about Peak, what it was intended to be.
Peak was on our mind the whole time we were working on Blue Mobile. And that it came right out of Blue Mobile. Like, so we were working on Blue, and in order to build a business that sort of met the aims that this guy O'Brien had in mind to like be a big, like it was kind of an ego thing for him. And so every time we had like a sensible kind of market launch plan, he wanted us to make it bigger. So the only way to meet his kind of ego aims was to do something really broad and low cost and sort of mass market. But there was a technology changeover happening in 2006 and 7. It was about to happen, which was to smartphones. And so that's what was on our mind. You know, when I was working at McKinsey, I would leave my office, and whatever time of day I left my office, whether it was at 4 p.m. or 10 p.m., I would walk from 53rd and Park to the subway. And in that particular part of the world, every person you saw was just walking like a zombie, looking at a BlackBerry with both thumbs on the screen. And I noticed this, and I just thought it was so amazing. I mean, today that's like everywhere, every corner, every spot.
I was going to say, as they are now.
Yeah. But I saw that, and I'm like, that's everyone's going to do that. Like, I really felt that. And so I did some analysis. We, you know, partly because of my consulting, like, access to research, there were only a handful of people in the world that had BlackBerries. I mean, people remember BlackBerry, but in 2006, there were only 6 million BlackBerries in the entire world out of 6 billion people. And 6 million BlackBerries is just like, it's really nothing. I mean, there were probably another 4 million Palm devices or 6 million, I don't know, some smallish number. And it was just like insanely, it seemed so clear that there would be a total mass market, the prices would come much lower. And one day, everybody would have these things, and they would do all the internet stuff, especially email. Like, the thing that really gripped me about email is that was the thing that was really gluing people to the internet in 2005, 6, 7, and over time, that has changed to some other stuff. So as O'Brien was walking away from Blue Mobile, I was like, fine, whatever. This thing had gone badly awry already. It was clear in the, you know, as we were going along that Blue was in a ill-fated journey. But John and I looked at each other and were like, cool, great, let's get out of this thing and start a real company that has a real opportunity that we see clearly and uses some of the same nuts and bolts that we've used in what we did with Virgin Mobile. Let's take an inevitable mass market technology and make it mass market. It's expensive, it's hard to get, you know, business people have it right now. That was like 99, 2000 with cell phones, like just the loud talking salesman on a cell phone. Well, now everyone has cell phones. So in 2006 and 7, we're like, all right, there's some of these like fancy people in big cities that have email and internet gadgets. Let's make an email or an internet gadget that everyone can afford. What would that take? And so we rethought the whole gadget, the whole phone, and we redesigned it from scratch to be 90% less costly. So we made a device that only cost $30 that had a nice big screen and keyboard on it, and it worked on the wireless network, and it did email and did push email in real time, which was like a big deal at the time, and you could do texting on it and Twitter and get Facebook alerts and stuff over time. And so like we invented something really cool, something quite neat, and we had to build a bunch of software to make it do that. That's what Peak was about. And so we raised some venture for that, and we developed the technology further. We got Target again on board, that big retailer. We got T-Mobile as one of the partners, and we launched it in 2008, September 12th, 2008. To like rave reviews, the New York Times was, review, all that.
One of Oprah's favorite things.
It was all that kind of stuff. Yeah,
I got a couple of Time Magazine's Gadget of the Year in 2008 when Time Magazine was still a thing. It's almost like when BlackBerry was the thing when Time was.
Yeah,
the thing,
yeah, it was like a changeover from the past era to the present era. Yeah. And by the way, September 12, 2008, when I'm watching at like noon on Power Lunch on CNBC, when they're going to feature our gadget, and our PR people had told us we're going to be like the headline beautiful gadget that they're glowing about. That happened to be the same day that Lehman Brothers was collapsing, and that every other headline was like, the world is over, the world is over, the world is over. And now, right, in other news, check out this cool new gadget that you could buy with all that extra money you have. So it created a very difficult macro for when we launched. So 2008, 9, 10 were insane for everybody on the planet, but especially for VC-backed companies. It was sick.
And then, I mean, but Peak had some success. Like, what was Peak at its peak?
Well, we, you know, in the beginning, and like our claim to fame is just selling tons of devices, and we booked a lot of revenue, much more revenue than most startups that I know, just getting people signed up to use our mobile devices with internet. They were all around the U.S. We launched in Europe. We launched in India. We had launch partners in other countries, and we were really rolling. But as the sort of financial crisis was getting more and more severe and enduring, we were like, okay, there's no way we're going to be able to grow very big, because we have to spend for every customer we grow. We're going to have to, like, we'll never get there. What we should probably do is just drop making the devices, which had been the thing that made us famous, like this beautiful gadget we made. We'll drop that. We'll take all the technology we developed, and we'll license it to the guys who make these horrible garbage devices that come from China, all these Huawei's and ZTE's and stuff. Because the trend of 2008 to 2012, apart from the rise of Apple, was the death of all the old school cell phone brands. Like Motorola used to be like a huge brand, and right, it more or less went to zero in that period. All that oxygen was not taken by Apple. Apple sells a lot of phones, and the very valuable phones, but the volume of phones during that time was taken by all these guys from China, like ZTE and Huawei and all these names that aren't even very important names. Well, you could see them if you pay attention around, even in the US market. So we started licensing our software to those guys, and that turned out to be a real business for us. So some of these giant companies, you hear about them now because they've gotten so big. There's this one called Xiaomi in China. It's like a $50 billion startup that everyone sells these cheap Android phones that are really nice. And there's one in India called Micromax, which is pretty similar. Companies like that were licensing our software to make their kind of crappy phones work better. And then in the end of 2012, one of the companies that had licensed our stuff bought the company. It was called SoftBank, Bharti SoftBank. SoftBank has a joint venture in India called Bharti SoftBank. It's a partnership with one of the big operators there. And they wanted to launch all these internet apps. They wanted to do like a chat app that was similar to WhatsApp and stuff. And so they licensed our platform. And then a year later, they bought the entire platform for us. And they built a really huge product. It's called Hike. And Hike has like 150 million users or something. So it's like this really, it's kind of cool. Yeah, like the Peak technology is built into one of the largest messaging platforms in the world. It's great. And by the way, while we were working on all that stuff in Asia, we had this team of amazing engineers in New York, and we were trying to like just think of what should we do with them. So we met this guy, Dom Hoffman, and we built Vine and launched it. And when Dom's company, Vine, which was just him and like one guy, got bought by Twitter, our people were all optioned to Twitter. So when Bharti SoftBank got our business, we did a side deal with the people. And so then at the sort of fall of 2012, December 2012, I'm like, it's all done.
Right.
You know, the Indians have what they want, and you know, the Twitter people. And I had this big office on 17th Street with no people, and I'm like, all right, I guess I should think of something new to do.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it. This is Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast, a show about entrepreneurs and their stories.
I want to go back though, because I'm curious, because you said, like, you know, you just the funding environment was such that it just it wasn't realistic for you to raise the kind of money that it would take. But I'm assuming, you know, the times were like they were today, like they are today. You know, let's say, I mean, you know, you could have gone out and done some wild raise of $100 million. I mean, was it a money problem? Could you have made it? I mean, would Peak be around today? Or
I mean, if you look at some of the businesses that are there now, I mean, that was all right. That was what we were doing. Like, we were well on our way on what they do. So, like, Xiaomi is this Chinese company started by the guy who used to be the head of Google in China. And I forget what year, maybe it was like 2012 that he started it. But he was like, why is there not an Apple in China? I'm going to work with all the Chinese ecosystem to make phones, but I'm going to make really cool looking ones instead of the crappy ones they make. I'm going to put my software on it, license Android and modify it, and then I'm going to sell cool phones. Well, that was all right. That's what we did. I mean, Android didn't exist in 2008 when we started, but we used like whatever the leading edge stuff was at the time. We made a beautiful thing. We're on the covers of every magazine and on every TV show. We made like the gorgeous IT device. So I, you know, like, they're definitely amazing at what they do, and they were definitely targeting a different region and stuff than what we did. So this is by no means inevitable that we could have pulled all that off. But it's like the timing made a huge difference. Like, they were launching right into this like roaring China liquidity market, and they raised, you know, 50 on 200 before they started. Then they raised another 100 on a billion 3 months later, and then they raised 500 on 5 billion 7 months later. So the access to capital for those dudes was definitely a big part, because to build a business like that, it is super capital intensive. Yeah. When we did Virgin Mobile, we raised $550 million before we launched. And so that was like in the period right after, like overlapping with and right after the initial dot-com crash. So it was 2001. Mm-hmm. That was an insane amount of money. We spent like a few million in the early, super early stage of development, but to launch it, we just like, we raised a mountain of money. So that was huge. Then when we did Peak, our plan, like our business plan, was let's raise an initial round of $10 million. So the Series A. I mean, entrepreneurs who are listening to us talk, in the present environment, people do not raise on a PowerPoint $10 million. Mm-hmm. Like, there's many steps: the seed, the pre-seed, the angel. Like, there's so many steps. But we raised on a PowerPoint $10 million with a plan to raise another 10 or 15, and then to raise 50, and then to raise 100. And like the fully funded plan for us to be like a major U.S. player would have been a lot of money. Like, it's not even. It just, I mean, it's an old school business compared to the internet businesses people now run too, right? Like, there's a cost of acquisition. You have to spend $25 to $50 to get a customer. And right. Some of that's like paid to target, and some of that's ads, and some of that's here and there and whatever. So even if you have an amazing business that pays back quickly and is very profitable, you're going to have to plow a bunch of cash in to get big. And so the reality about Peak and in that macro, I mean, I'm convinced a big part of it was the... just, you know, the collapsing overall environment. People were running away from everything. There was definitely other things. I mean, strategically speaking, the incredible success of Apple and how badly Android competed with them was a problem for us as well. Android went to free between 2008 and 2010.
Right.
And that's like, you know, so Google was basically just giving away free phones that do tons of stuff.
Right.
With their various partners.
Tough to compete with free.
Yeah, it was very annoying.
Very annoying with this smile. You just get this like tremendous visual of you know, kind of like, okay, you sell off your technology, your people kind of move into Vine and Twitter, and you did the, you know, the, I think everyone can understand what I'm doing here with the sound, but you know, the wiping your hands, like. Was it that clean, or did you? Were you just like, okay, I got nothing to do today. I'm just starting over. Or were there 15 projects on the go right away? How much time did you take off? Basically, is what I'm asking in a neater and tidier way, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I started to. I mean, when the deal was coming together for Peak, I could tell, and. I mean, it was like a much appreciated opportunity to switch gears and think about some new stuff, you know. So it was like super energizing, you know. Like, I would sign the last stuff in some part, like early December or whatever. And I definitely changed my rhythms a bit. Like, our office, we canceled the lease, and I just took it again in my own name because I was friendly with the landlord. And it was a pretty big office. It's like a 6,000 square foot floor of a nice building in 17th Street downtown near Union Square, and I just set up some friends' companies in there, so then they were there, so I got out of it, And I joined a club, and I would just go sit in the club and like relax and read the internet and write emails and think about things that I wanted to work on. And I started making a list of ideas that I thought were interesting ideas from a diverse grouping. It was like they just, you know, I had a few, I guess, I wanted them to be big. I wanted them to be doable now, but they didn't have to be all in one family of technologies. So there was an assortment of different stuff that I was thinking about. And Halo was one of the things that was on my list. So probably for a few months, even before December 2012, it was on my list, and I was starting to think about it and look at it. And that experiment, the anecdote I told you about, might have been like December 23rd, 2012 or something. Right. I forget the exact day. And I had a few other ideas that I was kicking around that I was starting to develop and prototype and think about as well. And one of them became Notable. Notable right. is probably the biggest use of my time and energy for the last couple of years.
So Notable is what you kind of said, like Halo, one of your co-founders kind of maybe committing more of his time to the leadership.
Yeah, I mean, Notable's my co-founder runs it, right? So for him, okay. It's like wall to wall, and he's an amazing guy, and he's doing really well with it. And I support him in that. So Notable, I'm on the hook for every little thing that goes on. So I'm the CEO, all the people report to me. And that's a different set of obligations than...
So tell us about Notable. Do you ever give us the background on this?
Yeah, I mean, Notable is an app for working together. So it's software. So unlike all my previous adventures with gadgets, there's no gadget involved with Notable. Notable is an internet company. We make, you know, some apps for phones and stuff and internet, a web app. And it is a way to take notes and share them. And that's it. I mean, it's for this world where everybody's like moving around, working in different places, different time zones, not together. And in this world, we're working on ideas, information, things we need to move around. And there's tons of emerging technologies the last few years for this kind of collaboration, right? Like the age of Microsoft ended a few years ago when mm-hmm. we were all like sending email attachments with like Excel spreadsheets. So that's over. And we now live in an age where there's a bunch of really specific apps where you work together. Like you use Dropbox and you send files. You use this task manager, like Asana or something, to assign the task to me. And then you switch into like a Google Hangout and we have a video chat, and then we switch again into Calendar or I don't know. There's just all these like things that are completely detached from each other. But if I ask you like, hey, how'd the podcast go? Like, it's not in any one place. It's in, like, 50 different places. There's, like, right. an email and a meeting maker and all that. And so our thought with Notable was, like, there's got to be some way to, like, wrangle this mess of different stuff. Like, you're not going to, like, go into Slack and search and then go over to GitHub and look for the commit and then go back to Asana and then find the file. Like, it'd be nice if there was a way to just drop a wide diversity of stuff into one kind of thing. So the idea of, like, a piece of paper or a room that you're in is, like, a really old school sort of comforting metaphor. But we were thinking, okay, Notable lets you make notepads, which you know, you make like a link, it's like a web page or it's a screen in your app. And a notepad, you can just drop any kind of thing in it. So you can write some words, great, you can take some notes, that's cool. You can put some files in or take pictures, or you can copy links from the internet and it sucks in the stuff from the internet in there. You can make some tasks or put a deadline on something. So you get a lot of different stuff. You can drag it around, you can keep editing it, so it's dynamic, it's not just like a repo. And you can put people on it. So I could put you on a notepad about this podcast, and then you might send a link and drop it in there, and I could listen to it, and I'd reply and comment on there, and then you'd be like, okay, cool, let me delete that one, and I'll put the next revision on here. And we can work on it together and keep moving it forward in this little notepad for this one little project. Like, it would be kind of overkill if you and me made, like, a whole base camp or, like, some project Gantt or something for just, like, you know, recording and editing one session. But it isn't crazy that there might be a little bit more of a sticky, kind of organized space for all our diverse projects. And a little bit, it speaks to my own background, right? Like, the stuff I do, I work on a lot of different stuff. I'm not sitting and working on one thing linearly. And I think it is reflective of people's increasingly, like, freelance, 24/7, mobile, multi-time zone work. Everyone's doing that. And Notable is a tool for this world where there's tons of different services, tons of different scattered collaborators. You get one page, lots of stuff. Look at the same page.
I'm curious, like, you've had such a, like, you've had exits, and you've had some businesses shut down, and you've had, you know, like, big venture-backed companies. I mean, it's such a, you know, a lot of exciting companies here. I'm going somewhere here. And, like, how do you find the energy to bring it to the, you know, each day, to the next, to Notable, to start over again, and where does it come from? Do you have any trouble motivating?
That's interesting. I really like the stuff I work on, man.
Yeah.
But
do you feel like your intensity level is the same as it was? Is that linear? I mean, is that a planar? I guess I don't know.
I really like what I work on. I left consulting. McKinsey was a great place full of interesting people, but I really didn't like the things I was working on. I didn't feel like anyone was going to do them, and even if they did them, it wouldn't really matter. Like, mm-hmm. We'd save, 2% for some sales force that was marketing some kind of enterprise service. Like, it just completely just didn't feel like it had any relevance to anything. And when you build products for people to use and you build companies that create those products, it's super rewarding. It's just, you just see the impact of your action all the time. So that part's really good. But there's also some negatives, and it is it's really, like, it can be really wearying and hard, and it's a roller coaster and it's intense, and I think that's one of the biggest things that entrepreneurs need to learn is just like how to their sort of personal and social self-regulation and conduct to just deal with it, because if you can't survive it, then you just can't do it.
Last two questions, moving to the union of business and art here, because the building you developed in 2008, which I actually biked by the other day and
cool.
Looked at just totally coincidentally before I had knew you had done this. It's there is a real artistic quality to it. I mean, it looks like a Richard Serra, kind of bronzing on the outside.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, it's Corten steel. I mean, the architect that we worked with was awesome, and his mandate was to make something pretty dope. And we, worked together a lot in some of those ideas. Like, I had all these little snippets of things. We wanted to make something amazing.
But in trying to build something that was amazing, I mean, was there a willingness to sacrifice profit? It was like, was there artistic goal? I mean, I'm sure it was.
Yeah.
You still did fine on it, but
my idea, I thought that it would be more valuable because we made something great, and I think I was probably wrong. I probably should have made like a shit box, and it would have made more money.
Okay. I guess you got the heart of my question for me there. Yeah. Well, okay. Last question then.
Maybe in the long run, it'll turn out that we did much better than I thought. But
are they rental units? Are they?
We didn't sell anything yet. Yeah.
Oh,
so eventually we'll sell some. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So for the time being, it rents well. People like it. It attracts certain people. But it is, when you make something really amazing, you do need to present it to people that want things that are amazing. And so. That's just part of it, so not everyone likes our building. Mm-hmm. They're like, oh, it's weird. What's with this? What's with that? It's like, all right, well, screw you. Get out of here. I don't want you here.
Right.
And that actually is, it took some meditation to realize that. It's not like everybody will look at it. And when they launched the iPhone, there was great acclaim, but they only sold like a million in the first year. It's not like...
Right. No,
It takes some fortitude. That was what I mean. It's like vision. There's more to... bringing your vision to reality than just making your vision, because you have to now convert the world is what happens after.
My brothers, my sister and my brother-in-law are both architects, and so I find myself sometimes uncertain of a building, but at least appreciative of the effort to try something that is different, and so I'm like, I just look at something sometimes, I'm like, you know what? I don't even know, but like, well done. You know, sort of. It's sort of a
well,
strange thought. But in your case, actually, I did quite. I thought it was really interesting. I like the exterior facade for sure. Last question: What's the photo you have in the two questions? What is the photo of, and how does one enter it into the permanent collection? You're just like, I got this cool picture. I'll just send it to like the MoMA and see if they accept it.
Yeah, it was super random. The picture is a picture of a lamp, a lamp post in Central Park, and I took it on a digital camera, early days of digital cameras, and I edited it on my computer, and I copied and pasted the same lamp post twice in the image. So there were these two lamp posts that are like weirdly close together, and they look a little bit like the Twin Towers. And after 9/11, there was a show at MoMA where they were like, hey, give us some pictures. It's like a monument to the, disaster. We'll, like, have everybody who wants to. And so somebody mentioned it to me. I was like, okay, you can take this one. They were like at my house and they were going to go to mommy's. I was like, why don't you take this one? And they kept some of the pictures that were featured in media. So weirdly, like that picture somehow was like on TV because like people that came and did reviews of the show like showed it. And so they kept some of the pictures and that mine was one of them. So it's not like, I don't think it's like the front door that artists dream of for like being in the permanent collection, but somehow magically I'm in some, you know, some archive somewhere.
Well, that's certainly another story that no one's ever told on the podcast and very interesting. Well, I want to really thank you for being here. It's been truly, really eye-opening. Entrepreneurial biography, as we sometimes call them on the show. Thanks so much for sharing your story.
It was a really pleasure.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.